This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Some Republican senators are suggesting today that there will have to be changes made to the GOP plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act. As of this morning, 56 Republican lawmakers have either voiced doubts or said they would vote against it. And that's presumably enough lawmakers to kill the bill in both chambers. Dr. Lori Glimcher, the relatively new president and CEO of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, has several concerns about the repeal and replace bill. And when we sat down with her in her office today, we started by asking her about her reservations.
You know, obviously I'm very concerned about it. There are a number of serious consequences if the act were to go through as it currently is, as it's been presented.
What do you think is the major one that folks here would notice?
Well, I would say that we're talking about an $880 billion cut to Medicaid by 2026 with inadequate tax credits. So for this state, Medicaid block grants or tax credits are not going to come close to what we have now.
But, you know, obviously a lot of people felt that something needed to be done, that the ACA wasn't working for them, that they weren't able to keep their doctor, that their premiums went up, that the costs were still out of control and nothing was done for the costs. So
And I think that, the ACA is not perfect. It's certainly not perfect. But for us in Massachusetts, 40% of the state budget is health care. And of that, 50%, something like that, is Medicaid, or actually the majority of it is Medicaid. And 56% of the Medicaid dollars are coming from the federal government. So you can imagine what impact that will have on Massachusetts.
So you said for us, so you're calling yourself us, part of Massachusetts, but you're relatively new. Back to Massachusetts,
yeah.
Even though we're in your office now, and you can still see where you went to high school. but you're new back here at Dana-Farber. You came from Cornell. Why did you decide to come back here and to come to Dana-Farber in particular?
Well, as you say, I'm Boston-born and
you're
bred.
A native.
I'm a native. Three generations of my family have been at Harvard. My dad was physician scientist. He was chair of orthopedics at the MGH and then at Children's Hospital. My first husband was a transplant surgeon at the Mass General. I trained at the Mass General. Now my son is a cardiothoracic surgery fellow at the Mass General.
Oh.
So I grew up in Brookline, and then we moved to Newton to raise the kids. And so this is really my home. I was eager for a change a few years ago. I thought that I could probably have more impact heading an organization than just concentrating on my own laboratory, which is why I accepted the offer to move to New York City and be the dean at Weill Cornell. And that was a steep learning curve and a fantastic experience. I like to call it exhilarating and exhausting both. And I really did intend to stay for another term there. But when I got the call asking me if I would consider being the CEO and president here, honestly, I just couldn't resist because Dana-Farber is an amazing institution. And it is also a revolutionary time for cancer.
You're the first woman to run Dana-Farber.
I was also the first woman to be dean of any medical school in New York State. So
so you've shattered. You've shattered some glass ceilings.
I'm used to being, on boards and committees where I may be the only woman. That's gotten better.
Do you think it's gotten better? I remember you also were part of the board, I think, at Harvard after the brouhaha over former Harvard President Larry Summers' comments about women not being innately able as men in STEM fields and science, right? Science, technology, and math fields.
I was on Larry Summers' task force for women in science and engineering. Did spend quite a lot of time in that task force, and we came up with a lot of suggestions for how things could improve, mm-hmm. some of which have been realized and some of which haven't been realized. Honestly, 30 years ago, if you had asked me what would it look like for women now, I would have said that we would have more women in senior leadership positions, we would have come further than we have come. I think we still haven't quite figured out how to reconcile biology with careers. You know, it's tough. I went through it myself. I have three kids, and my first husband was a surgeon, so I did 90% of the child care. And marrying that with a busy career is not easy. I was fortunate to be able to have some live-in help, and particularly fortunate because my parents lived 10 minutes away, and they were very helpful as well. We have to make it more doable for women.
And your reputation is that you've done that.
I spent a lot of... It's near and dear to my heart. I was able, while I was running a big lab, we were well enough funded that I could provide technical support to my female graduate students and postdoctoral fellows who had young children, who were the primary caregivers of young children. So I could provide them technical help, which kind of leveled the playing field. Because, you know, for so many years, my day was conscripted, right? I didn't have time to kind of sit around and chat like my male colleagues. I was on a very tight schedule.
Right.
And I wanted to make it easier for younger women. And so I did a number of things at Weill Cornell when I got there. We didn't have a child care center. So I said, we're going to have a child care center. We can't not have a child care center. I was also able to raise some additional funds for assistant professors, young faculty, who could benefit from an influx of funds at a particularly critical time in their career, which is usually, or sometimes anyway, at the assistant to associate professor transition. That's when you have kids at home, your startup package funds may have run out, but if you make, you know, a big discovery, you want to be able to really push it with everything that you have. And having an influx of funds, whether it's $50,000, $100,000, at that point can be really transformative. It allows you to hire a couple more postdocs or technicians or buy a piece of equipment you really need to go after that discovery.
Speaking of fundraising, because this was recently in the news, was the controversy and the protests over Dana-Farber's fundraiser at Mar-a-Lago, the Trump White House in Florida, if you call it that, the Winter White House. There are a bunch of different names for it, and folks were really questioning why Dana-Farber continued to hold that fundraiser when there were certain things happening at the White House that seemed contradictory to what the hospital was all about. What do you say to folks? I know that the hospital has since said it won't hold fundraisers and controversial venues in the future like that, but what do you say to folks who still have lingering concerns?
To me, you know, we are focused on trying to treat cancer, to take the best care of patients we can with cancer and to come up with new treatments for the cancers that we can't yet treat. That is our mission. We are a nonpartisan, non-political, non-profit organization. We don't make political statements, and we felt that canceling a fundraiser that had been scheduled a year and a half ago, 2 weeks before the fundraiser, was a political statement. It was a difficult few weeks. It really was because, our values here, our core values here are humanistic. We have many wonderful scientists and physicians that come from other countries. This is a country that has benefited enormously from immigration. You know, my grandparents came from Russia at the time of the pogroms in the early 1900s. We welcome everybody to the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Let's talk about some of those cancer innovations now,
I think, yeah,
because those are really exciting. And WBUR did do a series on some of them, and there's a lot going on with immunotherapy, which
yes,
you're particularly qualified. So I'm wondering, first, before we talk about how do you pay for that, because some of it's very expensive, and that, to me, was very surprising in our series when I found out about the cost. But what do you think are really some of the most exciting immunotherapy developments that you've seen right now?
This is a field that has been waiting to happen for over 100 years. Immunotherapy has been shown to be effective in some patients who have kidney cancer, bladder cancer, Hodgkin's lymphoma. That was the work of Margaret Shipp here at Dana-Farber. We now have roughly 40% of patients with melanoma who respond either to monotherapy or do even better if you combine. So these are patients who presented with stage 4 metastatic melanoma, which is a lethal disease, essentially on death's door. And now about 20% of such patients seem to be in durable remissions for up to 10 years. That's what I call a transformative medicine. Absolutely transformative medicine. There's still, the majority of patients don't respond to immunotherapy. And that tells us we're just at the tip of the iceberg.
So I just want to ask you about cost quickly, because when I spoke with a patient during WBUR series on cancer, she said that her pharmaceutical company was actually helping to pay for the immunotherapy for her type of cancer at the time, and it was, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for that. What about the role of pharmaceutical companies in all of this? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, let me say first that I've been on the board of directors of Bristol-Myers Squibb, which is obviously a leading company in the area of immuno-oncology. So I want to be completely transparent about that. I'm also an academician and a basic scientist and somebody responsible for making sure that patients have access to all the medicines they need. You know, as I have been exposed to the pharmaceutical industry, I've been impressed by the passion and devotion of the people that work there.
But there are also problems with conflicts, right? I mean, maybe people are, you know, medical professionals are getting paid by pharmaceutical companies to do things that aren't always in the best interest of the patient. Right?
Well, that's why we have the Sunshine Act, right? And it's very important that academic institutions like the Dana-Farber have very, very strict conflict of interest policies, which we do. Everything has to be reported. I mean, you know, as Justice Louis Brandeis said, sunlight's the best disinfectant. So we require that all of our faculty fully disclose any potential conflicts.
So what's your priority as leader of the ship here? Is it the new advances in immunotherapy that you were referring
We are really unique here at Dana-Farber in a couple ways. And one is that we have an almost equal balance between our researchers and our clinicians. Clinical revenue helps to support our research. And in a time when NIH funding, although we do very well with NIH funding, we're very competitive, nevertheless, over the last decade, it's gone down in real dollar terms by 25%. So we're in a very difficult era. So we have to support all those researchers. I mean, they're great at getting grants, but research is incredibly expensive. And the increasing cost of research is way beyond inflation. You know, nothing could make me happier than to think that any of the discoveries we've made in our laboratory on the tumor microenvironment could turn into a drug to treat patients. I would hesitate to ever say we're going to cure cancer in 10 years, but if we could make it a chronic disease, at least for some cancers, like basic research coupled with innovative technology was able to turn HIV from a lethal disease into a chronic disease, I think we'd all be pretty happy.
It's a big goal.
It's a big goal. But, you know, if you don't reach for the moon, Maybe you can get to the stars, right?
Right.
But you got to reach. And you know, as a researcher and a scientist myself, you got to take big risks. You have to try for the big discoveries that will really be transformative.
Well, thanks very much, Dr. Glimcher. Nice talking with you, and good luck with these big goals.
Thank you.
Dr. Lori Glimcher is president and CEO of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. You can find more information about WBUR's series, This Moment in Cancer, at our website, radioboston.org.